Ray Weil is one of our founding members, someone who needs very little introduction. Say he is a retired from librarian from Queens and one of the foremost scholars on the early history of the phonograph. And he has some groundbreaking information to present about what happened in the 90s, not the 1990s, but the 1890s. Here's Ray Weil.
This is not a Y2K problem. I don't know what you would call it when you go into it. Before I begin, a couple of little asides. I started this research, or started going over to the Edison site, about 1954 and 1955. And over the period, there have been so many people that I have met and I have known and that unfortunately are no longer with us. Melvin Weig, who was the first superintendent of the site and one the local homegrown one, and I don't think they've ever really replaced Melvin since he left. Harold Anderson, Norman Spiden, and of course, with many of us, Leah Burt, whom I had hopes would be able to make it here. There were others, Doug Tarr. They're too numerous to mention, really, but they were all helpful. I had gotten this idea of doing the history of the industry in the early 1970s. I was working at a college library. We had faculty rank, and you know what that means about publisher perish. So I got a very, 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 very small grant from the New Jersey Historical Society, and then later one from the City University Faculty Research Group. And with that, nickeled and dimed my way through the research. The first thing that I managed to try and do was, I knew that if I delayed one aspect of the research, I would never do it. So the first thing I tackled was something that I don't think anyone else has tackled, and that is the tissue letter books. Have any of you ever used tissue letter books in a research? It's man's inhumanity to man. When they were making a copy, you didn't make carbon paper. You wrote your original document in a special ink or your typewritten document with a special typewriter ribbon. You put a piece of damp tissue paper on it. You put it under pressure. And then you took the result and you bound them all up. If the thing was a good one, you could almost read it. If it was not, it was almost completely illegible. So I went through those and then went to the document files. This was pre-Peterson. I don't know if you know our infamous Dr. Peterson, who had slightly sticky fingers, very, very sticky fingers. And what he could do for research, I don't know. Thank God I had done most of my research before it had the Peterson touch. Some of the documents we'll be reproducing here may no longer exist there because they were copied pre-Peterson. Especially one coming from the New Jersey scrapbook. I don't know if they ever did recover that. Also, one other aside, and then I go into my marathon. This, by the way, started out as a half-hour paper, since I really hadn't touched this part of the documentation in about 10 or 15 years. It growed like topsy and did topsy grow. The other thing is that I have a slight disclaimer in here. We are running one of Glenn Sage's audio tracks. And Glenn wants to point out, if anyone asks, all the recordings on the CD are without any reverb, noise reduction, or any other sonic enhancement games. I think that's important for what you're going to hear in the one track we're going to show. Now to go into our marathon. At the beginning of the Edison reinvolvement of the phonograph, he began an extensive series of experiments in creating record matrices, in recording and in the production of duplicated records. As far as I can see, this photo that was mounted by the site onto the web shows a very, very, very primitive way of making copies in Edison House in London. If you'll notice over here, this big horn, which is obviously a reproducing horn, and right next to it, shoved into it, is this other horn going to a machine. So you're making a primitive audio copy of the recording. Some of the early stuff, the Stanley recordings, Trumpeter Lansbury, and some of the others, may have been copied in this manner. Now, at the same time this happened, the subject of another paper which I'm working on, Albert K. Keller was paid from Ezra T. Gilliland's private account to develop a coin-operated phonograph, and Franz Schutzberg, a member of Edison's laboratory staff, began a series of experiments on molding. Is there any light up here, Mike? Do you know?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Assisted by Charles Wirth, beginning in April 1888, experiments were conducted in plating cylinders with silver and later gold in a vacuum. On August 17, 1888, his notebook contained the following remarks, translated through the courtesy of one of the court cases. After 1.5 hours, the middle of the cylinder has a gold-like, and an unclear word, the rims deep green, the glass a golden luster, and a transparent light deep blue, which color is shadowing down at the rims to reddish. After taking out, the deposit has a handsome gold surface. Hurrah! By 1890, regular experiments in molding records were occurring. Work was also conducted on creating copies by means other than molding. Walter Miller, later to become Edison's head of recording band, began work for him in 1887 and testified later in the 90s that he began experimenting with duplicates in 1888, as far as he could recall. On being further questioned, did you make any duplicating machines? Yes, sir. During that year, I think we were experimenting in 1888. Did you produce a commercially successful duplicate? Well, we were selling duplicates in 1889 and 1890. Do you remember ever taking a duplicate that was made on a machine that you had been working on over to the North American Phonograph Company to show it to them? Yes, sir. Later, Mr. Miller stated this was in 1889. Was that duplicate that you took over there one that was of such a character as to be commercially successful? Well, that was made on paraffin wax, and it was as good a record as any record that was commercial at that time. Mr. Miller then proceeded to explain that the cylinder material was much softer than the substance in use in 1898, the date of his testimony. In the negotiations with Jesse Lippincott that resulted in the formation of the North American Phonograph Company, Edison had specifically reserved the right to supply musical records. Once that company was established, an active program of supplying musical records from West Orange occurred. But there were many complaints from the local companies about the quality of cylinders, and as a result, Edison categorically refused to continue the practice. An examination of the first book of phonograph records, Edison Laboratory, that had been maintained by A. Theo E. Wangerman, shows this to have occurred after January 20th, 1890. This is confirmed by a letter of January 23rd, 1890, addressed by Edison to the Edison Phonograph Works. I have read the correspondence from the various phonograph companies addressed to the North American Phonograph Company and referred to them to yourselves, complaining of the quality of musical records furnished from my laboratory. In response to your inquiries regarding these complaints, I beg to say that I have permitted musical records to be made here purely as a matter of accommodating to the North American people. So long as the work required none of my personal attention, I had no objection to it being carried on in my laboratory. But the number of complaints that I have been asked to read lately has shown me very clearly that this business must be handled by someone who has more time to devote to it than I have, or perhaps it more satisfactory for the different phonograph companies to make their own records. I have today closed my music room and discharged the staff lately employed there. After that point, entries cease in the log except for some special purpose recordings. There was an entry for recordings for the Lenox Lyceum held in April 1890, and then others taken for Minneapolis and also in South America. However, on August the 23rd, clarinet cylinders were made for duplicating, and on October 9th, the same occurred. Some recordings were also made for the Emperor of Germany. In a letter to S.B. Eaton on December 11th, 1890, Edison now was taking a new tack. I do not want to make original cylinders and have no objection to the local companies making them. What I want is the manufacturing of duplicates, which are very different things from records made by musicians direct. Again, on December 24th, 1890, additional records were taken for duplicating. On February 21st, 1891, A.O. Tate was able to report to the secretary of the Iowa Phonograph Company, Mr. Edison's process for duplicating phonographic records is just about in shape and will be put into operation as early as practical. These records will have to be obtained by the various local companies through the North American Phonograph Company. The National Phonograph Association met in New York in June of 1891. And during the meeting, representatives of the various companies were asked to visit the Edison Laboratory and Phonograph Works. The reaction to the visit was about immediate when the various members returned home to their respective companies. Kentucky Phonograph Company requested, "We would like samples of new records as soon as possible. We are ready to place very large order for same if satisfactory." At the end of July, six samples were sent to each of the phonograph companies. A letter was then sent out. That's okay, fine. A letter, this is from that New Jersey Phonograph Company scrapbook. As I say, I hope they recovered it. "We have sent to you by express a sample case containing six boxes of duplicated musical records, and beg to advise you that we are prepared to furnish them in moderate quantity. The charge for duplicating, not including cylinders, packing, or boxing, will be 35 cents for each cylinder. In ordering duplicate records, you will please place a requisition with the North American Phonograph Company for the desired number of cylinders, instructing them to make delivery of same to the laboratory. Upon receipt of these, they will be duplicated and shipped in accordance with your instructions. The charge for boxing and packing, as per sample, will be as follows. Small paper single cylinder boxes, 3.5 cents each. Large box and packing, 25 cents. Should you send us any cylinders for the purpose of having the records transferred, we can furnish 30 to 150 duplicates of good quality at prices named above, providing the former reach us in perfect condition and are free from scratching. You will find inside of one of the paper boxes of samples referred to a small weight, which if attached to the reproducer weight of the phonograph, will improve reproduction and prevent the cylinders from whistling." Now that little weight was an important bit of business because one of the Edison techniques with a molded cylinder was to be able to get the blankety-blank thing, I'm not being corny with the blank here, out of the mold. And the recording grooves prior to this time were too deep, and so you could not rotate the cylinder out of the mold. However, with a shallower recording groove, you could rotate it out. And if you played it with the weight, you had enough weight to track the shallower grooves. At the second convention, Walter Miller had differentiated between the two classes of phonograms which they will furnish under the duplicating system. Mr. Edison is not yet in a position to furnish the more expensive ones, presumably molded. He would want a guarantee of a certain amount of money before he would start the more elaborate process. he would have to have a guarantee before he would go along with that. But as to these duplicates, this is the pantographed ones, he was willing to furnish them at 50 cents apiece. The cylinders by the more expensive process are absolutely perfect. And you can get as many as a million duplicates. Boy, those people can go sky high with their estimates from one master. Whereby by the other process, you cannot get over 200, although we are not prepared to say positively how many duplicates we can furnish under the process we are now, of which we are now speaking. A.W. Clancy, the president of the association, then remarked, "It is proper to say that we have heard from the duplicate records very excellent music and talk, and we can get these at 50 cents apiece. The price of the expensive cylinder to which we listened will have to be settled by the question of demand. Mr. Edison stated personally that he would not undertake to do anything of that kind without orders for 500 or 600 a day. The process involved inserting a warm blank cylinder into a heated mold and expanding it against the walls. After the blank had partially cooled, it was rotated out. This meant that the master had to be made with a much shallower groove, as I mentioned. The process was much better, but was very expensive and was obviously not completely commercial. Mr. McClellan of the State Phonograph Company of Illinois then remarked, "Mr. Miller, I suppose that all the musical records you send out will have the title upon the end of the cylinder, as we have seen arranged at the laboratory yesterday?" "Mr. Miller, yes, they will be fixed up that way." Immediately a problem, and this particular segment I think is crucial because I think you'll see why in a moment. Immediately a problem arose involving molded records as indicated by Tate in a letter to J.W. Wilson, manager of the Spokane Phonograph Company. "We note what you say in regard to putting the word duplicate on the cylinder. We would omit this from any of the records you order from us." Tate added the following at the bottom of the letter, of his letter to them. "I find out this cannot be omitted from the records made from our present masters. It is on all of them. Can correct this in the future, though." He then reported to Edison, "They state that people think they are being sold and are not getting music from original cylinders. One or two of the companies have objected very seriously to it, and if it is really unimportant, I would like to have it left off of all future masters we make." Now, what does this say about the records that were being supplied at this period by the Edison people? It says that they were supplying duplicates in two forms. One, very few molded copies, and number two, most of them would be pantographed copies. After some correspondence between Tate and Lombard of the North American Phonograph Company, a modus operandi was evolved and expressed in a circular to the local companies. Because at the time, I won't read it to you. It's right there. Tate also was looking for a large amount of business, and so one of the tissue letter copies was the form for a postcard. I wonder if anyone's ever stumbled across it, for a receipt of their order. An inventory prepared, and this will be the next thing that we have, by Walter Miller on October 1st, 1891, giving a statement of expenses. Thank God for the tissue letter books with these. That's one of the reasons why it's slightly fuzzy. Also, the fact that I thought we didn't have an opaque projector, so this was set up for an overhead, and unfortunately, my capability of making copies on my own equipment was not that good, so you've had probably a little bleeding of ink. Notice over at the right here, these are the figures of duplicate cylinders sent out up until this time. Up here at the very top is a figure of the cost of the electroplating they had done at that time. Now, if they were not issuing any of these particular cylinders, $22,232.10 for electroplating is a hell of a lot of money for that particular time. Notice that they have duplicating cylinders, cost of it. They have in the figures also duplicating equipment. So it's quite an interesting little document, and only in the tissue letter books. I'll bet that in the Edison Papers Project, this is not one of the things that's been included. I haven't checked, but I'll be almost willing to bet money that it's not. Having taken stock, A.O. Tate then requested Thomas McGuire at the Edison Laboratory to send out a circular to all of the phonograph companies as soon as we are prepared to supply new musical records. We should send these notices out two or three times a week. In fact, every day if necessary, and at the end of each month or some other period which we can decide upon later, we will correct our catalog. Try and find one. For anyone interested in hearing what a molded record probably sounded like, I would suggest opening up the following website, http://www.our friend tinfoil.com/CM9806HTM. And would you play the audio track 14? And you will hear what is, I believe is a molded cylinder. Listen to the quality of it. If you listen to other things that Glenn has on his thing, there are two others on this particular segment, which is the one of the North American period that he issued. You will find out that these do not have a sort of muffled quality that all of the surrounding cylinders have that were obviously pantographed. I'm sure that these are original cylinders. Glenn and his site had said that they must just be an original that was issued. My belief is, since I can match them all with lists of matrices that were made in this particular period, that they must be molded cylinders. I can even give you the matrix number on the thing, which I have elsewhere. But all was not well with the operation. While the duplicating may have been successful, the work of the shipping department was lousy. I won't go into the details of it, but the packing material, the way in which they set it up, the Excelsior would get caught on the surface of the record. With a very soft recording surface, there were problems. The New England Phonograph Company, Tate had been busily obtaining record cylinders from some of the companies for comparison and, in all probability, having some of them duplicated. At present, we know of second-party orders of records from Columbia, for Tim Brooks, New Jersey, Chicago Central, and New York. There were probably others. In the case of Chicago Central, 12 were received on January 1892. Walter Miller examined these and reports that they are very much inferior to our records in quality, tone, and volume. Shipment consists of two vocal and 10 band recordings, the latter made by the U.S. Marine and Old Guard bands. Walter's of the opinion that only seven of the records are duplicates and the other five are originals. He thinks that the method of duplication employed by Chicago Central is simply to record on one phonograph the reproduction of another. By January 13th, the Edison Group seemingly was relying solely on mechanical duplication. So our first experiment with mechanical and with molded cylinders has gone down the drain. Miller was asked to close down and cut off all possible expense. At the end of his report, he suggested that I think it would be an excellent policy on the part of the North American Phonograph Company to stop these local companies from continuing in business as semi-manufacturers. The New England Phonograph Company, however, had already vigorously protested against the entry of Edison upon the recorded music scene. We have received a circular from you dated December 18, 1891, in which you quote that you have in stock duplicates of the celebrated Casey records, enumerating the same. And we desire to say that we must ask you to discontinue the manufacture of these, as duplicates of these records are solely the property of the New England Phonograph Company. Mr. Russell Hunting, under contract with this company to make these records, made the first records that were ever made of that series for this company, and has already been connected with this company. We cannot allow his records to be duplicated and put upon the market at all. This matter we feel very strongly upon, as we have developed this series of records ourselves, been at a great deal of expense to fit up and make them, and have coached Mr. Hunting in the method of using the phonograph and introduced it to him. Trouble in Eden. The entire situation was summed by Thomas R. Lombard in remarks delivered to the 1892 convention. Basically, he recounts how Edison shut down on copying and how North American had to come into the business. By this time, the following companies reported that they were making musical records: Missouri, New Jersey, Michigan, Columbia, New England, Ohio, Kansas, Louisiana, New York, and North American. To these must be added Chicago Central, as noted in Miller's comments. Also at this period, another person got involved with making duplicating apparatus. Edward Amott later reported that during the World's Fair fall, 1893, he began experimenting on the phonograph for duplicating records, and he designed one that was used by the Chicago Talking Machine Company. He had two patents on different designs of duplicating machines. Of the group, Edward Dennison Easton, representing Columbia, boasted, "We sell more records than all the other manufacturers combined. The Columbia Phonograph Company has had many a proud day, but this is the proudest day of our existence. We have learned today that we do more business than the Edison Phonograph Works, because it has been stated that their output there is $1,000 per week, and we do more business than that." However, it is unclear if Easton was including the sale or rental of machines within his figures. Of the group of local companies reporting a role in the making of records, New Jersey, New England, New York, Columbia, Louisiana, and Ohio advertised the availability of their records in the Phonogram, the trade magazine, on a regular basis. Columbia, from an early point, had developed an extremely popular item with its recordings of the United States Marine Band, and constantly had advertised these recordings in the Phonogram. In a court case, it prepared to defend these rights. George Tewksbury and Leonard Garfield Spencer have come into the District of Columbia bringing a number of phonographs together with a large supply of cylinders and appliances for the same, and have made a contract with the said United States Marine Band to play into said phonographs, and in this manner to make records for the preservation and reproduction of the musical performances of said band, and for the sale of same. By the time the paperwork had been completed in the case, some damage had been done, and even though a restraining order had been granted, the later possession of Marine Corps recordings by the United States Phonograph Company may be attributable to this incident. Until it became possible to produce an acceptable duplicate, and we now need illustration number 8 and company, it was necessary to have an artist repeat a selection endlessly in front of a batch of recording horns. Band might succeed in making 20 recordings of various kinds, or 6 or 7 if it were just a vocalist. A session would involve the repetition of an announcement on all the machines and then turning them on for the recording purpose. The whole question of producing copies was complicated by the need to reproduce a cylindrical object so that much of the inventive activity was directed towards developing methods of transferring the material. Here is one of the pantographing items. Familiar name is the patentee. I don't know if any of you have heard of that particular name involved with the history and his spider reproducing diaphragm and cutter, but old Bettini. Here's another familiar name in the industry, Mr. McDonald of Columbia. Still another one, we have a very familiar name. This was introduced in a court case. This is the Edison pantographing item. You can see how the pantograph works. This is probably the easiest one to see. You see the one cylinder. You see the other cylinder. You see they run right opposed to one another. And you have a little offset on the needle there, so in case there's any problem in tracking, it will follow the groove. I don't have a patent picture of it because I don't think it was ever really patented, but this is one of our wonderful court cases. And here is the original Douglas conception of just taking a speaking tube and attaching two phonographs together. You would get a copy, but it would be very muffled if you've ever tried to listen at the end of a speaking tube to see what it is like. Okay, now, and every local company had some local expert working for them, and they all had their own individual homegrown devices. Many of the sales of records involved sales between the local companies to satisfy the demand of their nickel-in-a-slot coin-operated amusement phonographs. If I ever get next year's paper done on the Automatic Exhibition Phonograph Company and the beginnings of the entertainment industry, you will have the next exciting installment in the saga. Now, what had happened in the beginning of North American is that the promoter of North American had this idea. He didn't have that much money. He was not the wealthy millionaire that Tate had thought that he was. And since the poor guy died relatively early in the history of the phonograph, he was never around to really defend himself. Incidentally, he was one of the first to show the insanity that seems to be prevalent in the industry. Sad. But you'll have another person later in this paper who is involved with it. Okay. Now, in order to dig North American out of the hole that it had gotten into at the early part of its history, I won't go into that too much, that will come later. In order to work down their debts and pay them off, they finally decided to sell phonographs. Before that, it was strictly a lease thing, although the original contract said it could be either lease or sale. Soon as they tried to sell them, though, another company, the Automatic Phonograph Exhibition Company, brought suit against them because they realized very, very well that if they had allowed the sale of phonographs, they would be out of business because the way in which they could control it was through the local companies, and if the local companies were selling phonographs, they couldn't control the nickel-in-the-slot machines. So they brought suit against North American to prevent them from doing this. North American was effectively stopped from doing it for 2 years. The thing was finally settled on July 12, 1892, and then North American could start selling phonographs. Now, this is important for our history because until you had the sale of phonographs, the only sale of records was basically for somebody who was very wealthy, who was renting a phonograph for himself. And how many of them were around in that period of wages, which weren't even $20 a week at that time, I guess. I'm thinking of the 30s, where $20 a week could be a good salary. But with the sale of phonographs now, you know, not only have the local phonograph companies, but you also have real live individuals who can go out and buy records. A.O. Tate, now vice president of North American, was constantly worried that Edison's duplicating process would be stolen. I mean, now it's even more important. In January 1893, he wrote to Edison, "Following your suggestions, I have placed Walter Miller in charge of our musical record department. He is going to send Hagen down to see me, and I will engage Hagen as an assistant to Miller. I am satisfied that we can keep the duplicating process secret as the phonograph works in the toy building. We will adopt every precaution to effect this end. This change will facilitate our work to a large degree. It will prevent the necessity of handling our records to as many times as necessary under the present conditions." The next paragraph, I think, for many of our collectors will be an important one. In September, he gave one of the few indications that we have as to the number of selections that were stocked and sold. Up to the 23rd of September, the total shipments amounted to 7,109. As stated in my communication, we had made up to that date 18,626, and we had on hand at 14th Street 11,517. We have 120 different selections. We are obliged to keep a stock of each kind, which varies from 25 to 150 records. We shall always be obliged to carry a stock of not less than 20,000 records for the reason that the number of selections will increase from time to time. Of course, there will be a great many where from 6 to 12 of one kind would be sufficient. But band records and other other classes of musical records will have to be made in large quantities. There has never been any trouble with the market for records. The trouble has been that until within the past 2 months, the North American Phonograph Company never produced a record that was fit to sell. The result being that the New Jersey and one or two other companies took the trade. There is a market today between 150,000 and 200,000 records per year. And this I have verified by reference to the shipments of cylinders to the companies who have been supplying this particular trade. Time for illustration number 9. The phonograph in its December 1892 issue, which appeared probably in late or January or February 1893, the phonogram was also late in its publication, like the phonoscope, gave an indication of the growing popularity of the recording artist when it published an article, "Famous Record Makers and Their Works." Now, if you look at that, you will see down at the bottom, Tim Brooks' favorite.
Yes.
Right over there, George W. The article also gives an indication of the original company that provided a cylinder. For instance, Pat Brady records of Dan Kelly were done for the Ohio Company. The article intimated that 5,000 had been sold. W.F. Denny worked exclusively for the New England Phonograph Company. Other artists were mentioned, but their output was not attributed to any particular company. On February 16, 1893, a new player arrived at the scene when a certificate of incorporation for the United States Phonograph Company was filed with the Secretary of State of New Jersey. Almost immediately, a new name, George E. Tewksbury, became associated with the new company. He had been involved in the industry from the beginning, and with S.S. Ott, was a principal investor in at least one local company, the Kansas Phonograph Company. Kansas was a major player in schemes to transship phonographs to England in contravention of the rights of the Edison United Phonograph Company. Almost immediately, the company approached the American Graphophone Company on the possibility of obtaining a license, having already purchased the rights of the New Jersey Phonograph Company. I wonder what Victor Emerson had, what involvement he had in the sale of the rights. Of course, Victor was the chief recorder for New Jersey and been involved with the company. He then becomes the chief recorder for United States Phonograph and stays with them for some time. United States Phonograph immediately starts to try and get a license from American Graphophone Company. The thing peters along. There's a proposed form of agreement that is made in May, but the negotiations break down completely in August. However, soon the American Graphophone Company, on behalf of the Columbia Phonograph Company, was ordering records from the United States Phonograph Company. Notice everyone's patting the other one on the head and saying, let's have something here. These blanks, they had this one idea that, we'll buy records, but we'll pay for it partially in forms of cylinders. And so they start supplying them with the so-called infamous blue cylinders. I don't know if you've heard of the blue cylinders of this particular period. What happened is the formula that Columbia tried to copy from Edison was not completely right. And so after the cylinders had been around for a little while, they began to get this blue efflorescence on the surface. Basically, from what I understand, in playback, the stuff would scuff right off, but it made the records completely unsaleable. Once this is settled, they are still dealing United States Phono and Columbia American Graphophone. In a deposition prepared in opposition to a motion for a preliminary injunction, George E. Tewksbury stated, "It was found impractical to supply the public demand with originals, for it was impossible to keep a full stock of all subjects advertised, and to make them as ordered was, of course, too expensive. Therefore, it became the practice to keep in stock one or two especially good original records of each title as master records, and to make copies from it to fill orders as received." This was a situation in October 1894 when the Graphophone Company filed its bill in the court to restrain the United States Phonograph Company from making and selling records. You may buy from them, but at the same time, you'll sue them in order to protect your patent. The suit was eventually settled as part of the general compromise between the Edison and the Graphophone interests in December 1896, but more later on that. On October 20th, 1894, Cremellin of the Columbia Phonograph Company wrote, "Your favor of the 19th instant, acknowledging receipt of our recent order for 173 records, has been duly received. We thank you for your pleasant attitude on this respect. The list of records necessary to complete the order for 1,000 is now being prepared and will be forwarded to you when completed. We note also the increase in price of your records to $650 per 1,000. Please observe particularly that master records are what we desire, free from scratches or imperfections of any kind." In testimony, Calvin G. Child, it's a name that's familiar with to a lot of people with his later Victor connections, formerly of the New England Phonograph Company, but working after January 1894 for the Columbia Phonograph Company, mentioned United States Phono supplying them with records of Baldwin's cadet band. He almost immediately reported to Easton and Frank Dorian that they were supplying copies. Dorian and Easton didn't believe him, but Childs said, they've got to be copies, because the color of the blanks is not the color of the blanks that we recorded them on. You know, you had these periods where the blanks that Edison was supplying were darker color, lighter color, and so forth. But the color of the duplicate, the lighter color, was a complete giveaway. Ordering must have been continuous, since Frank Dorian, the Columbia manager, wrote a year later, returning 31 records and complaining, we do not believe you have been receiving your better records recently. We are willing to pay a dollar apiece net for first-class original records. They must be smooth and otherwise perfect, both musically and mechanically. There must have been further correspondence, since Columbia agreed to pay from $1 to $3 for perfect master records according to subject, and immediately placed a new order on October the 10th, 1895, for a grand total of 55 subjects. On the 12th, U.S. Phono noted that there were so many titles asked for that they only could supply a few titles immediately. To make new masters, especially for you, would require a great deal of time and expense that no order of this kind would justify. We can, however, furnish you at once with the orchestras and the Spencers and one or two of the others that, if you desire. Columba replied, forward the Eisler and Spencer records and any of the others which you can furnish. Columbia was merely mirroring the practices of many of the local companies that maintain nickel and the slot exhibitions, both recording locally and purchasing and in all probability copying the products of other producers of recordings.